House Speaker, some few weeks ago, received his plane fare to come down here, and he immediately went out and bought him a new suit. But he, having promised Dave that he was coming, he knew that he had to get here some way, and he finally raised enough money to catch a train. And this was the slowest damn train that you have ever seen or ever heard of in your life. He got on this train, and he was worried about making the connection. And it was creeping along. You could see a flower burst into full bloom before it got past. And he walked up to the conductor, awfully worried about this thing. And he says, "Conductor, can't you run a little faster?" And the conductor said, "Yes, but I think I ought to stay with the train." And along about this time, a very worried man came up and told the conductor. He said, "Conductor, my wife is about to have a baby. I've just got to get her to a hospital." And the conductor said, "Well, she ought to have had better sense than to get on the train in that condition." And he said, "Well, she wasn't." Now, seriously, Dave and I went up to Greensboro last night and met Paul. And, of course, riding back with Dave and Paul, I don't get to say much. But I found out a lot about this man. I found out something that I like. I found out that he's Big Book AA. And that's my kind of AA. I love it. I told Paul up in the room a while ago that he didn't have to tell me anything about himself, that Dave had already told me, and he said, "Oh, my God, I'm ruined." Paul comes to us from Riverside, Illinois, but Paul also comes to us from here. Paul, it's a pleasure to have you with us, and would you kindly step up here and tell your experience, your strength, and your hope.
Thank you, Sidney. Good evening. My name is Paul Martin, and I'm an alcoholic. My life has become a little unmanageable in the last couple of hours. At dinner, I accidentally ate Cliff's apple strudel and gave him a resentment. Went up to my room and whacked my head on the corner of a cabinet, and if you got a head like mine, that's a problem. I'm sorry my old friend Tommy Breen isn't here, because there's a sentimental tune I always like to dedicate to Tommy in honor of his scanty thatch on top. It's called, "Just Because Your Head Looks Like a Hubcap, Don't Think That You're a Big Wheel." Glad to be sober. I'm glad to be a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. It's good to see old friends and new friends. I was talking with Jack Boland earlier today. Somebody wanted to know why Boland was so happy. That's easy. He just found out he could use right guard under his left arm. I hadn't seen Dave for quite a while. I was interested talking with him to learn that when he was younger, he studied to be an artist. And he gave it up because he wanted to paint this beautiful model in the nude, and she wouldn't let him. She made him put on his bathrobe. I'm grateful to be sober. I'm grateful to be a member of Alcoholics Anonymous, because it's in AA that I've learned some things that I never knew before in my life. Number one, I didn't know how to stay sober, but beyond this, I didn't know how to live. In an AA, kind of slowly and usually reluctantly, I've learned some things that have changed my life and continue to change it as I make an effort to follow this program as the way it's lined out. I think it's pretty specific. I've learned, too, that I'd better be careful what I ask for, because I'm liable to get it and then wonder how to get rid of it. I used to pray, "Please, God, get those so-and-sos out of my hair," and you see what happened. Being an alcoholic and a member of AA is the best thing that ever happened to me. It makes sense out of my life completely. Out of the life I had since AA, but out of the life also that I had before I came to this fellowship. Because it was through pain and misery and stupidity and ignorance that I finally reached a point of surrender within myself that I was willing to listen to somebody else. Alfred Korzybski once said that God may forgive your sins, but your nervous system won't. AA comes to terms with something. It comes to terms with guilt. And I had a great deal of this. Because I had elected when I was quite young to live life on my own terms. And this worked fairly well for a while, and then it worked less and less well. If I've learned anything as a member of AA, it is that this program works, but it does not work on my terms. It works on the terms of those 12 steps which we just heard. And the longer I'm in AA, the more I'm convinced that this is for me. You shall know the truth, and the truth shall make you nervous. AA has given me the ability to look at myself, and I find that the longer I stay sober in this fellowship, the more clearly I become able to see who, where, and what I am, and as this happens, the better able I am to identify with another alcoholic. I think it's ridiculous to suppose that I know God, or can know God, if I don't even know myself. I think this is where it begins. And I found that by working and reworking these 12 steps, I become freer within myself, and I become better able to understand another human being. I haven't become perfect, and I'm sure that's a surprise to all of you, but it is not to my friends back in Chicago. I think that perfection is where this thing aims, though. I think it aims at removing all of my character defects. And I think it aims at absolute honesty and absolute unselfishness, and I'll never get there. But I think this is what the goal is. And I certainly agree with that world-famous philosopher, Phyllis Diller, who said, aim high and you won't shoot your foot off. I think if I aim at 100%, I'm going to make a better score than if I aim at 50%. I read the other day that her husband was not being charged with desertion, but leaving the scene of an accident. When I came into AA, I had become very, very skilled at keeping anybody from ever knowing who I really was or what I really thought. You could ask me what time it was, and with clocks on every wall, I could talk for half an hour and never tell you. I became very talented in the roundabout, indirect, evasive answer. Very talented at keeping people at arm's length in whatever way was necessary. As I came into AA, a little bit of this fear and this shell began to slip away and melt. I began to find some people in whom I could believe. I didn't believe in anything when I came into AA. I had a very strict religious upbringing. I come from a long line of Lutheran ministers. I heard the old rugged cross so many times, I thought it was the national anthem. And I'd gotten a long way away from this. I believed in nothing when I came into AA, and I heard them talk about a higher power, and I thought, well, you know, that's all right, if they need this. I stuck around, and I began to believe in the people long before I could believe in God, because I saw that these folks were for real. They not only knew how to stay sober, they knew how to live. And if I had ever known this, I had forgotten it long before. I began to see that this talk about honesty was important, and I believe it, even though I stole Cliff's apple strudel tonight. I began to see little by little as I moved along and stayed sober in AA that the program would take me places where I had never gone before in my life. If I would first of all be honest and try to follow it on its terms and not my own. If I would one day at a time use these principles, stay a part of this fellowship, and perhaps slowly but necessarily become what I should be. I don't know why I'm an alcoholic, and I don't really care. I know that I've had great problems with self-will and continue to. And I know that to the degree that I follow this program as it's supposed to be, it changes me. And it's to the degree that I try to break these rules, I break myself on them. I think it's like a little like breaking a wild horse. You don't ruin it and break its spirit. It becomes disciplined and useful. It becomes something other than a collection of instincts and unchanneled energy. And I think this is what will happen with me in AA if I begin to use these 12 steps. Alcoholism is a disease, and it's a disease that an awful lot of folks seem to have. And AA is the answer. I was talking with some folks earlier today about the pill problem around our area. I assume that you folks have as much difficulty with it as we have in Chicago. I don't think there is any easy answer for me. I think the answer is to face myself and to face problems. I was interested in seeing again the correspondence between Carl Jung and Bill Wilson in the Grapevine this month. And in there, Jung says that for the alcoholic, spirit is the answer for spirits. That what the drunk is looking for is God, a relationship with a power greater than himself. Not finding it, he drowns his frustration in booze. Well, I would have laughed that idea out of existence when I was drinking, and as I look back on it now, I think it's correct. I think this is what I wanted. And I think to some degree I found this kind of freedom in alcohol when I drank. Because booze did something pretty good for me, and it did it pretty early. I grew up in a small, quiet, dull town of a few thousand people. There wasn't much going on. I found that when I drank, things changed for the better. It was so dull there that if you took LSD, you would have had visions of Lawrence Welk. But when I drank, this was all changed for the better. It was so small that if you plugged in your electric razor, the streetlights used to dim. But everything changed for the better with the right amount of booze. And I went back to this stuff again and again and again, and it worked. I don't know how many of you can remember what booze did for you, but I can remember the state that I would get into, and I would be free. When I was sober, I was shy, I was anxious, I was nervous, I would get depressed, I would wonder what are people saying or thinking about me. When I drank, that was all changed. I was free in a way that I was never free again until I'd been in AA for a good while. All these fears and anxieties and idiocies would drop away, and the world was good. And I can remember how this felt when it worked. And I can see why, knowing that this was available, it was so necessary for me to go back and find this state. And I can see, too, that why, when I went on the wagon, it was so miserable. Because there was always something groaning and screaming and grinding within me, and I would have to take some booze and quiet this. And that's what would happen. I would go on the wagon, and eventually I would get drunk because I couldn't make it alone. There's a Mohammedan proverb that says nobody gets to heaven except by leaning on the shoulder of someone he has helped. And my experience in AA tells me that this is true, that you and I need each other and lean on each other and help each other because we couldn't make it any other way. I drank my way through high school. I drank my way through several colleges. The war had come along. I went into service. I was living in the Chicago area at that time. I'd been boxing for a club on the west side of Chicago. Went into service as a pilot in the Navy, and I had kind of a poor war record. Booze was a great help to me along in those years. And I would only get drunk on weekends as a cadet, because that's the only time they'd let me out. And that was my recreation. I got commissioned, and things were beautiful because I could get drunk every night, and this is what I did. Get up in the morning, take my gagging exercises, go down to the flight line and try all over again. I'd get drunk that night. I had pneumonia and DTs along about there. Now, this is kind of hard to explain to a social drinker, but I was still a social drinker. I got out of the hospital. I was in the hospital for 4 weeks, and I was drunk 9 out of the last 10 nights in the hospital. Figure that one out. So I hadn't learned too much, but I got out, and I went right back to the drinking. Now, I was blacking out by this time. I started blacking out when I was 19 or 20. By the time I was 23, I had DTs. The war was ending in December of 1945. I'd been drunk home for 30 days leave. I went to Norfolk, Virginia. I was drunk there for 3 weeks and got separated. Something strange had happened to my drinking along about then, and I couldn't quite understand it, because the thing that had worked so well was no longer working. There's a change that the alcoholic experiences, which you and I have each experienced, and that is the release is no longer there. I've come to know, as a sober member of AA, that there's a difference between relief and release. There's a difference between relief from character defects, from resentment or depression, and a real release from these things, a real freedom. And AA brings me freedom, if I'll use it as it's lined out. I continued to drink after I got out of service. I had the idea that I had a lot of evil companions, and these were the ones that were leading me astray. I read those 20 questions after I got sober. It said, do you seek lower companions when you drink? I thought, yeah, that's right. I'd been sober quite a bit longer when I realized that I had become an evil companion. I didn't have to seek him. I got out of service in December of 45, and I drank for several weeks around Chicago, and I decided I needed a little relaxation, and I started out for Cincinnati for New Year's Eve. I was going to spend several days there, and I got a little sidetracked, and I wound up in Milwaukee instead. I was drunk up there for 3 days. I wound up with what had to be the ugliest woman in the Middle West. She could have been named Playgirl of the Month by Popular Mechanics. She looked so bad. I came back from there, and I thought, I've got to do something about this drinking. So I went on the wagon for 6 weeks. I went up to Glenview to fly. I had gotten a commercial pilot's license while I was in the Navy. My war record was really not exceptional. I destroyed 2 aircraft, both of which belonged to the United States Navy. A friend of mine pointed out along the way there that if I had gotten 3 more, I would have been a Japanese ace. But after that episode up in Milwaukee, I thought, well, something is going wrong with the quality of my drinking, and I'll go on the wagon. And I did, and I stayed sober for 6 weeks. I went up to Glenview to fly. I got drunk. I got lost in a snowstorm. Things were getting a little tough. I got bitten by a dog on that one. I took rabies shots for 2 weeks after that. I've often thought if I'd been thinking, I would have made a list of people to bite in case I developed rabies. I was talking to Doc Mooney today. I have had a little trouble with resentments along the way. But I decided maybe I should go on the wagon again. I was having all kinds of trouble. I was getting kind of sick here and there. As Al Church says, my liver was so low it had floor burns. Every morning I would get up and take my gagging exercises. It was kind of like a Japanese tea ceremony without the finesse. There was always a problem getting money into the bank and getting money out of the bank. It never stayed long enough to get up to room temperature. This was long before the days of the isometric exercises, but I used to get, you know, those exercises you take every morning. I had stomach muscles like bands of steel. And it was a tough way to go, but I continued to drink because I didn't know what else to do. This was my answer. It wasn't working too well, but it was all I had. I was looking for a relief. I couldn't even find oblivion at this point. The fun had run out, and I suffered from the familiar alcoholic obsession that I would once again arrange things and they would be as they had been when the booze was good. I wouldn't have these troubles and these problems with it anymore. And I would try this and I would try that. I would drink only beer. I quit mixing my booze with Coke and 7-Up and ginger ale because I was sure it was these mixes that were making me so sick in the morning. I quit smoking along the way because I thought maybe it was the cigarettes that made me have such a bad taste in the morning. Of course, none of these things worked. I was only hospitalized as a result of drinking once. That was with the pneumonium DTs while I was in service. I have a friend in the East who said he was in so many nut houses that every time he heard an ambulance bell, he used to get his pajamas and go sit on the front porch. This, however, was not my history. But as I drank, I would experiment. I began to read everything I could find on the subject of alcoholism. And I came to the realization that I was an alcoholic and I couldn't drink. And I would try to quit, and I couldn't stand life sober, and I would have to drink. This was before AA, but I would take a drink knowing that I couldn't handle it because I couldn't stand it sober. Tranquilizers had not been invented at that point, or I would have tried them because I needed relief from myself. There was no refuge at this point for me. I would wake up in the middle of the night, half drunk, and see what was happening in my life and be unable to do anything about it. I'd want to do something, and I was unable to. And I would remember how the booze had been. And I'm sure you do too, or you wouldn't be alcoholics. I would remember what this had once done, and now it no longer would. And I would try this, and I would try that. I didn't believe in God. I believed in nothing, including myself. But I became more and more hopeless that anything would ever straighten me out. You know, there's a community that we all live in. That's the town or the city. There's another kind of community, and that's the community that we find in AA. And that's a community of men and women who share their experience, strength, and hope to help each other to live. And this is what I did not have when I would try to quit on my own. I'd get sober, and then I would get drunk. And I would get drunk knowing that I couldn't handle booze. It says somewhere in the big book that self-knowledge is not enough, and I believe that. I had gotten educated beyond my intelligence, and I had forgotten some of the things that I think a kid knows on how to live. I had gotten too smart for these things, and I had run out of answers. All I had was booze, and this no longer was an answer, because for a long time, booze was not the problem. The problem was here, and booze was the answer. I drank, and I drank, and I'd get sober, and try it again, and it again would never work. So one day I called AA, and I had been sober for a week at that time, and I didn't think this would do anything for me. I'd heard something about AA. I thought maybe it was a bunch of Bible thumpers. I didn't really know. But I know if they had anything at all, I'd better go see what it was. The man talked to me for about 2 hours on a Saturday afternoon in August in Chicago, and it was a warm day, and I was pretty scared. And he said that this thing had kept him sober for 5 years. And I could tell from listening to him that he'd had a real booze problem. He told me pretty much what we all have to talk about, what he was like, what happened, and what he was like now. And I could see in his life the same progression in my own. And I know there's a progression in booze. To my knowledge, the medical profession knows two things about alcoholism. Number one, that this is a permanent ailment. I'll have this as long as I live. And number two, that this gets worse and worse and worse. I ran into a man in New York 2 years ago who had been sober 22 years in Alcoholics Anonymous, and he went out and took a drink. And in 3 days, he was in a hospital. In as bad shape as he had been in 22 years before. And I know that this would happen to me if I go out and take a drink. And as I listened to this man talk that day before I had gone to my first AA meeting, and I heard him talk, I knew that what he was saying applied to me. He didn't say, you're an alcoholic, you've got to quit drinking, you've got to do this. He just said, this is what happened to me, and if you want to go to a meeting, I'll take you. The next morning, he took me to a meeting at the Austin Breakfast on the west side of Chicago. It was a Sunday morning. There were 60 or 70 men and women there, and I heard somebody talk, and I heard some people comment, and he introduced me to them, and he drove me home. He said, these men and women are alcoholics by their own admission, and they're staying sober. If you want to quit drinking, I don't know what you believe in, and I don't care, but this is for you. Well, I walked out of that meeting, and I was still just as frightened and lonely and anxious and depressed as I had been when I walked in, because I didn't think anything was going to be any different. I walked out of that meeting, and I haven't had a drink since. And that was in 1947. So you can tell, for this alcoholic, this spiritual community we call AA is the answer. I thought, really, after I got sober and I didn't throw up anymore, and this was the first freedom I found in AA. Now I only throw up when I want to. We were talking about Julian's famous line that he got so sick he used to eat food that threw up easy so he wouldn't hurt himself. And this is kind of my experience. But I began to see that there was something here which I had never had before in my life. If I could single out one thing for which I am completely grateful in Alcoholics Anonymous, it is that now, today, my life makes some sense. It means something, and it never did before. I came into AA in August of 1947. I've spent about 7 years of that time away from the Chicago area. I worked on overseas construction jobs in the Arctic. I worked on the construction of the Air Force Base up in Thule, Greenland in 1951, 2, 3, and 4. I worked in Iceland in 1955. I worked in Point Barrow, Alaska in 1956 and 57. We had a very unique alcoholic in the group up in Point Barrow, Nick, whose father was Jewish and whose mother was Eskimo. He used to say that he was unusual in AA experience because he was the program's only Jewskimo. To my experience, that's correct. But I began to see that what I was supposed to do was turn my will and life over to God. I wasn't supposed to start making stipulations on what I wanted. I don't think that God is some kind of a cosmic candy machine, that he's there to give me what I want. I think what I'm here to do is start to learn on the basis of living as things are. I'm very much impressed with this. The more I go along and the more I've had experiences in getting what I want, the more I'm interested in accepting what I should have. It's like the diamond salesman who was out in Las Vegas. He was having a drink, and there was a beautiful blonde alongside of him, and he started talking to her about the famous diamonds that he knew. He said there's the Hope Diamond, the Kohinoor Diamond, and other diamonds. He said it's kind of remarkable because they all have a curse that comes with them. She said, yeah, that's interesting. And he noticed that she was wearing a very large diamond, and he said, that's an interesting diamond that you're wearing. She said, yes, that's the Plotkin diamond. He said, really, the Plotkin diamond? I never heard of that. She said, and there's a curse that comes with this. He said, what's the curse? She said, Mr. Plotkin. I think there's a pretty fair lesson in me for me on that. Because step 11 is very, very definite in saying that I should pray only for knowledge of God's will for me and the power to carry that out. And I believe that. The only things I really know about living, I've learned in Alcoholics Anonymous right here. I've learned it from you people. I've learned that AA does have answers for everything, really. I ran into a man in New York a few years ago who was celebrating 2 years of sobriety. And he remarked that when he came on the program, he had a drinking problem and a marriage problem. He said, AA straightened out my drinking problem, and my sponsor ran off with my wife, which straightened out my marriage problem. He said, that shows this program will work if you let it, and I believe him. I think that the 12 steps are minimums for me, not maximums. I think that these are minimums for my membership in AA. Anybody's a member in this thing who says he is. I believe that. All I have to do is say that I'm a member and this is where I belong. But I think if I'm going to follow the AA program, immediately there are some other things for me to do, and that involves change within me. If I use these steps, some very wonderful things happen to me, and if I don't use them, some very bad things happen. I mentioned to you that I had a little trouble stealing Cliff's strudel tonight. Well, I had a lot of trouble, and I was sober about a year. I haven't had a drink since I've been in AA, but I've had a few problems along the way with honesty. I sat in these meetings, and I heard this talk about honesty and telling the truth, and I thought, boy, that's pretty interesting. I believe that, and I talked about it, and I talked about how I had turned my will and life completely over to God. And I was sober about a year, and I almost went to jail for a dishonest business deal. Well, this made quite an impression on me. I thought maybe I've missed a few points in this program, and I realized that I had kept such an open mind that the whole program had blown right through. And I sat down and I read the book, and I saw that, boy, I have missed a great deal. And I saw this talk about the fourth step, a searching and fearless moral inventory. Well, I'd given a lot of people around help with theirs, and I still do that on occasion. Doesn't go over too well. You know, Socrates had a lot of trouble with that in Athens. Telling people what to do, they finally bought him a hemlock martini. But I sat down and I read the big book. And I saw that I had missed a great deal. I was sober, and I thought, you know, maybe this happened to you. When I drank, people used to say, Martin, you're a splendid fellow, you just drink too much. If you quit drinking, you'd be great. Well, I had quit drinking, and I thought I had become great, and here I was about to have those jail doors clang behind me. So I wrote out an inventory, and it was kind of a surprise to me. It was kind of a surprise, because I saw some things in myself which I had not really realized were there. I felt kind of like that Dennis the Menace cartoon I saw one time. Dennis was looking in the mirror, and he says, boy, if that wasn't me, I'd laugh. And this was my reaction. You know, step one defines the problem for me in this program. That's a life which is unmanageable and a powerlessness over alcohol. And step 12 shows me what the goal is. And that's a spiritual awakening as a result of these steps. I hear people say that all this program is about is not drinking. Just don't drink and everything will be all right. I don't believe that. There's a line in the big book that says our real purpose is to become of maximum service to God and the people around us. And I think that's true. Step one shows me what the problem is, and step 12 shows me what the goal is. And there are 10 steps in between which will take me from the problem to the goal. And that's a spiritual awakening as a result of these steps. I hear people say that all this program is about is not drinking. Just don't drink and everything will be all right. I don't believe that. There's a line in the big book that says our real purpose is to become of maximum service to God and the people around us, and I think that's true. Step one shows me what the problem is, and step 12 shows me what the goal is. And there are 10 steps in between which will take me from the problem to the goal, and that's a spiritual awakening. If I'm going to take a trip, I've got to know at least three things. Number one, where I am. Number two, where I'm going. And number three, how to get there. And where I'm going, I hope, is a continuing spiritual awakening. And how to get there is all of these steps. And after I wrote down that fourth step, a little later I took a fifth step. And an amazing thing happened. I had some things, like most drunks have, I think, and I said I was never going to discuss with anybody. And I sat there and I talked to this friend of mine, and something changed within me. Some of this wall that I had built up crumbled a little bit. And I think a little truth began to seep through. And I began to understand some things of this program which I had never been able to understand before. And I don't think I can understand really what this is all about until I do the work. I find values in living which I had never known because I had not been in a position to see them. You know, there was once a window washer who was washing the windows on this large apartment building, and he began to wash the bathroom window of one apartment. And there was a woman in the tub taking a bath, and he washed away, and she looked at him for a moment or two and rather tentatively stretched out of the tub and tapped on the window with her big toe. He just kept washing the window. So she stretched a little farther and rapped on the window with her entire foot, and he still kept washing the window. Finally, she stood up in the tub and stood there and waved like this. And with that, he lowered the window, stuck his head in the bathroom, and he said, "What the hell's the matter with you, lady? Haven't you ever seen a window washer before?" Well, there's a lot of values in living I could never possibly see until I've done the work in these steps. Never possibly see. I think they go pretty well, one following the other. And those years I spent up in the Arctic, I read that book every day, and I've read it again and again and again. I'll tell you, I'm sold on it. I do a lot of reading. I find a lot of interesting things to read. My trade is advertising and public relations, and knowledge of all kinds is useful to me in that. But nothing I have ever read can replace or come close to that big book for what I would call real knowledge. And by real knowledge, I mean something that teaches me how to live each day of my life. You know, PR, public relations, is a much older trade than a lot of you people realize. It goes back to biblical times when Moses was leading the Jews out of Egypt. They were stopped at the Red Sea. They couldn't get across. They milled around, and somebody jumped up and said, "We'll build a bridge and walk across." And they said, "No, that'll take too long." Somebody else said, "We'll build some boats and sail across." They said, "No, we'll be captured." Moses stepped forward and raised his staff, and he said, "I'll cause the waters of the Red Sea to part. We shall walk across on dry land, and when we get to the other side, I'll cause the waters to close and drown any pursuing Egyptians." And with that, a public relations man jumped up. He says, "Moses, baby, you do that, and I'll get you 4 pages in the Bible." But I began to see, as I began to stay sober, that this program would not just keep me sober, and this program would not just make my life a little better. This program would give me precisely what I had looked for in booze and precisely what I had found in booze for a long time before it got sour. It would give me a real freedom in living, a freedom from fear of the future or the past, a freedom from concern about people, what people were thinking or what they were saying, a freedom to start to become of some use to another human being. I'm a great believer in following these directions here. I think there's a big difference for me between activity and action. I can go to a lot of meetings, and this is activity which is useful. For me, it is no replacement for the action in the 12 steps. I have periodically, in the last years, gone back to reworking these steps, and I found that the ego does come off in layers. As you can see, I took off a few too many layers on top. Incidentally, I ran into a new hair grower not too long ago. Some man used it for 6 months. He only grew one hair, but it weighed 8 pounds. But I believe that I have to follow these directions and use them. And the longer I'm sober, the more I'm impressed with what these steps will do for me. You know, as I mentioned, when I was a kid, I decided that I could live life on my own terms, and that worked pretty badly. And as I came into AA, periodically I have tried to follow this program on my own terms, and that has very often worked very badly also. If I were in a plane flying at 20,000 feet and it caught on fire and somebody rushed up to me with a chute and said, "Put this on and go out that hatch and pull the ripcord and save your life," there are certain things I would not do at this point. I would not start a discussion on the philosophy of parachute manufacture. And I would not say, "Nobody's going to run my life for me." And I would not go through the hatch without a chute hollering, "This is an individual program." I would say, "Yes, sir, put on the chute, follow the directions, and hope that it worked." And I approach these 12 steps today with this same view. Because I had a spell after I got sober. I could see that this would do something for me and make my life a little easier. But I kept looking at a lot of other things. I thought maybe I need some philosophy or some psychology or some theology, and this will take me where the steps won't go. And very tardily, I ran into some views of a guy who's not an alcoholic, but he's a psychologist who's had a lot of experience with alcoholics and who admits himself that he's learned a great deal from the 12 steps and from the AA approach, this what he calls redemptive society. And it was through him that I ran into the idea of periodically writing out another inventory, periodically taking another fifth step, and then reworking all of these steps periodically. And I was amazed at what this did. His theory is that a person, using the phrase diseases of the conscience, if I suffer from depression, anxiety, hostility, any of these things, this is my conscience saying that something's wrong. And the answer certainly is not to take a pill. The answer is to face it and see what can be done. And he says also that not just drunks, but anybody who has a breakdown has been hiding from other people. And that the more people who know me just as I am, the better for me because the freer I become. I went through life, and I think most drunks do, with a role that I was playing. I had figured out this guy that I was going to be. And this is what I wanted everybody to think I was. And here I knew that this was not true. I knew that behind this facade there was the real guy. And I was always afraid that somebody would find out who I really was. And I began to see as I reworked these steps that I was free. That the guy that I presented to the outside and the guy that I really was came closer and closer. That the steps brought me closer and closer to the truth about myself. I think that the truth really will set me free, but not until I see it. The truth of my anger, my dishonesty, my hostility, my maneuvering and using people, I will only become free on this when I see it. Wilson Meisner, whom some of you may have heard of, was a well-known fight manager, con man, publicity man. Meisner had one of the best remarks on self-awareness I have ever seen. He said that the cuckoo who is onto himself is halfway out of the clock. And I began to see that the better I knew myself, the more free I began to become. Because I began to see that freedom in this program requires continuing work. You get what you pay for on no other basis, and you get a lot more than you put into it. I began to learn something about humility. I've never had much of a knack for this. I thought that humility was the art of looking ashamed while you say beautiful things about yourself. And I began to see that humility was recognizing myself as I really am. Not the guy that I said was worse than anybody else and not the guy I thought was better than anybody else, but recognizing that I have certain abilities and I can use these, and there are certain things I'll never be able to do. And that's no sweat, because this program will let me become what I should be and help me to be of some use in my life in a way that I never was able to be. There's only one promise in the steps, and I think that's interesting, too. It's the promise of a spiritual awakening as a result of these steps. I agree with that view of Jung's that the drunk looks for a spiritual awakening in booze, and I sure looked for it in some very unlikely places. I don't think it's possible that I can ever hide from anything in my life. I hear people say, forget the past, don't worry about it. I think it's all registered somewhere in here on a videotape, every scene and every sight and every sound. I can either call it up and face it and look at it and talk about it and react to it consciously, or I spend the rest of my life reacting to it unconsciously. I think that memory is linked with dishonesty. Bad memory is linked with dishonesty. When I came into AA, I couldn't remember anything because I had spent so much time lying about everything that I couldn't remember this or that. I continued to deny the truth about this situation and that situation, and I reached a point where I was unable to understand the reality of any situation. Because of lying and continuing lying, I had cut myself off from the truth, and my memory began to collapse. And I have found that by trying to live honestly, by spending some time in prayer and meditation, my memory has gotten far better. There's become an integration in my life that all kinds of things and experiences that I have had have become useful to me. I've come to believe in prayer. I don't go to church. I believe in God as I understand him. These are important words to me in AA because they let me into AA. I came in here a fallen away atheist. I believed in nothing. I believe in God as I understand him today because it's through the power of this group that I have experienced a change in my life for which I'm extremely grateful. And I don't think that AA membership is a matter of geography. I used to, when I was up on the ice cap in Greenland, the first year I went up was 1951. And I'd been sober 4 years. And every Sunday morning when I was around Chicago, I used to go to that Austin breakfast. It started at 10 o'clock in the morning and ended at 11. When I was up in Greenland, allowing for the difference in time on Sunday morning, I used to go somewhere where I could be by myself and I would join these people in the quiet time, several thousand miles away. And an hour would pass and I would go somewhere and I would join them in the Lord's Prayer. And I felt that though there were many, many miles separating us, I was still a member of AA and a member of this group, and I think this is true. Because membership is not a question of geography, it's a question of what am I doing with these 12 steps? Am I making an effort one day at a time to become what I should be? I found that by working hard and consistently at prayer, something changes within me again. I don't think that prayer is mysterious. Anybody who says that prayer is escapist has never tried to get up at 6 o'clock in the morning over a period of many months to spend some time in prayer and meditation. And I'm more and more impressed with those words, seeking only knowledge of His will for us and the power to carry that out. Because I find that quantity and quality in my prayer life are linked. I cannot control the quality of my prayer. I can control the quantity. And if I put enough time in, the quality gets better. It's been suggested that there are three levels in the spiritual life, three ranges. The first is a change in conduct. Now, as I've indicated, I've had a lot of trouble with dishonesty. Lying, stealing, cheating. I have less trouble than I used to have, but I still have some difficulty. So the first thing I have to do is straighten out my conduct. And if I persist in this, the second range comes into view, and that's a change in character. I don't have to buckle up my muscles and muscle my way into right behavior so much. I start to do this automatically because this becomes my nature. And if I persist in this long enough, I reach the third level, which is a change in consciousness, where I become an awakened person. And I think that's what this is about. That if I live on the basis of the truth that I can understand today, I will gain more truth and more understanding. And as I do this, I will become a little more useful. I find that prayer can be linked to pure research. This is not praying for anything in particular, this or that. I've done this and I've gotten it. And all I can say is that's a dangerous business from my experience. You know, there was once an Indian chief, and he came to the village council one day and he says, "Ugh, chief would like to trade 40-year-old squaw for 2 20-year-old squaws." And they said, "Well, come back tomorrow and we'll check on your request." And he returned the next day and they said, "Well, that's all right. You can trade your 40-year-old squaw for 2 20-year-old squaws." And the chief says, "Ugh, thank you." He came back a week later to the council and he says, "Ugh, chief would like 40-year-old squaw back." And they said, "How come, chief? You were in here a week ago. You wanted to trade her for 2 20-year-old squaws. We went along with the trade. Is something wrong?" He says, "Ugh, chief not wired for 220s. Well, that's a roundabout way of saying I'm real careful about what I pray for these days. Because I find that linking prayer to pure research, if I spend enough time on it, trying only to become aware of what God wants me to do and be, I get what I should have. I think that what I am within attracts my life. Whatever I should have, if I'm in the right shape, comes to me. Whether it's knowledge, whether it's people, whatever it is, the main thing is to get into condition. Those of you with scientific experience or interest know the place that pure research plays. This is scientific research which has no practical aim whatsoever, except to understand more scientific truth. But if this stops, all the practical applications will dry up. And I find that prayer on the third level, prayer in which I make an effort only to turn my will and life over to God, plays the part of pure research in my life. It changes me into what I am supposed to be. I find that as I've gone along in AA, little by little, I work for a different reason. I used to work for pain, and boy, did I hurt. I had depressions for 5 years after I got sober. I would get so depressed, I would sit in a chair and I couldn't move. If somebody said hello, it would take me 10 minutes to think of an answer. And I would go to meetings and I would say, "My God, I can't stand this. What should I do?" And they would say, "Go to meetings, don't drink, call people on the phone." I'd say, "Yeah, but I can't stand this. What should I do?" And they would tell me the same things. Well, as I stayed sober and went to meetings,
continued to work the steps. I reached a point where I no longer had depressions. All of these things began to change. I think the telephone is important. Call somebody. Used to be nickel therapy, it's dime therapy. I suppose eventually it'll be quarter therapy, but whatever it is, it's worth it. I have a friend who was sober 5 years, and he was in Fort Wayne, Indiana, and he decided he would get drunk. He hadn't had a drink for 5 years, but he said, I'm going to get drunk. But he said to himself, I always said before I took a drink, I would call somebody. So he went into his hotel, checked in, went up to his room, absolutely certain that he was going to get drunk, but he said, I'll just go through this routine, as pointless as it is. He went up to his room, and he called a person in Brookfield, Illinois, that he had said he would call. He made a person-to-person call. The man was not there. He hung up the phone. He made the call. He didn't get the guy he wanted to find, but he had completely lost any desire to drink because he had made the effort. For those who are of a historical mind, the bathtub was invented in 1850. The telephone was invented in 1875. If you had been living in 1850, you could have spent 25 years sitting in the tub without having the phone ring once. But I used to work for pain. I used to work because I hurt so badly that I couldn't stand it. And I'll tell you, this is quite an incentive. As time has passed, my motivation has changed a little bit. I see something now. I work perhaps as much from vision as from pain. I don't hurt much anymore. But I can see something here which is tremendous. And the only way I know to get there is to use these 12 steps, one day at a time. As I said, I don't think the program is just about not drinking. I think it's about changing and becoming the kind of person that I should be. And the only way I can possibly do this is through using these 12 steps, one day at a time. And I find each time I go back at these steps, I find something new in myself. I've changed my view on steps 8 and 9. I think that amends mean not just trying to straighten out important relationships with people that I have harmed. I think if I've got an important relationship in my life, a significant relationship, and I'm not at fault, I think in the spirit of steps 8 and 9, it's still a good idea for me to try to make that better for myself. Because I think wherever I've got a bad relationship, finally it hurts me. Because I think that in a way that I could not explain, but I think is true, the salvation of each of us is dependent on all of us. I think that we're one in a circulation in this community of strength and sobriety and sanity and love. And I think that if I do some work with these steps, maybe it helps the whole fellowship in the same way with you. And I think that maybe when one of us stumbles and gets drunk, it takes something away from the whole fellowship. I don't know as much about God or the steps of the program as I used to, but I know enough to be fully aware that this is where I want to stay the rest of my life. Because in AA, I found what I never experienced before in my life. It's real friendship and awareness of God as I understand Him, some sanity and some meaning. This goes where I want to go, and I want to stay part of it. Evelyn Underhill tells the story of a man who had a leaky roof on his house, and he prayed to the Lord to fix it. And the Lord came over, but he just didn't patch it. He ripped the whole roof off. And the guy said, thank you, sir. Put on a new roof. And then the Lord ripped out the foundation, and he began to put in a new foundation. And then he tore out one end of the house, and he put on a new addition. And he started repainting and renovating and remodeling the whole thing. And the man said, sir, this is all right, but I like it the way it is. I wish you'd leave it. It kind of bothers me and hurts me to make all these changes. Would you quit? And the Lord said, no. And the man said, how come? And the Lord said, because when it's all done, I want to come inside and live. And I think that this is what AA is all about. It's not that I just become a dried-up drunk who's about like he always was. I think it's that I become the person that I'm supposed to be. I can't do this alone any more than I can stay away from the first drink alone. But I can do it if I stay part of this fellowship, part of this community, and one day at a time, remember that this program does not and never will work on my terms. It works on the terms that are lined out in these 12 steps. Daytop Village is a haven for drug addicts in the East. And they have a creed which expresses their views of Daytop Village, which I think pretty well sums up what many of us think of AA. We are here because there is no refuge finally from ourselves. Until a person confronts himself in the eyes and hearts of others, he is running. Until he suffers them to share his secret, he has no safety from it. Afraid to be known, he can know neither himself nor any other. He will be alone. Where else but in our common ground can we find such a mirror? Here together, a person can at last appear clearly to himself, not as the giant of his dreams nor the dwarf of his fears, but as a man, part of a whole with his share in its purpose. In this ground, we can each take root and grow, not alone anymore as in death, but alive to ourselves and to others. And this is what I find here, a way to live that takes me where I should go. If I stick with you people and go to these meetings and try to follow these steps, I think one day at a time, I can begin to fulfill the purpose of this program, to become of maximum service to God and the people around me. I'm glad to be sober. I'm glad to be here. Thank you very much.